pressure cooker. Dad surveyed our work, counting the jars and muttering to himself. Then he turned to Mother and said, "It's not enough." That night, Dad called a family meeting, and we gathered around the kitchen table, because it was wide and long and could seat all of us. We had a right to know what we were up against, he said. He was standing at the head of the table, the rest of us perched on benches, studying the thick planks of red oak. "There's a family not far from here," Dad said. "They're freedom fighters. They wouldn't let the government brainwash their kids in them public schools, so the feds came after them." Dad exhaled, long and slow. "The feds surrounded the family's cabin, kept them locked in there for weeks, and when a hungry child, a little boy, snuck out to go hunting, the feds shot him dead." I scanned my brothers. I'd never seen fear on Luke's face before. "They're still in the cabin," Dad said. "They keep the lights off, and they crawl on the floor, away from the doors and windows. I don't know how much food they got. Might be they'll starve before the feds give up." No one spoke. Eventually, Luke, who was 12, asked if we could help. "No," Dad said. "Nobody can. They're trapped in their own home, but they got their guns. You can bet that's why the feds ain't charged in." He paused to sit, folding himself onto the low bench in slow, stiff movements. He looked old to my eyes, worn out. "We can't help them, but we can help ourselves. When the feds come to Buck's Peak, we'll be ready." That night, Dad dragged a pile of old army bags up from the basement. He said they were our head for the hills bags. We spent that night packing them with supplies, herbal medicines, water purifiers, flint and steel. Dad had bought several boxes of military MREs, meals ready to eat, and we put as many as we could fit into our packs, imagining the moment when, having fled the house and hiding ourselves in the wild plum trees near the creek, we'd eat them. Some of my brothers stowed guns in their packs, but I had only a small knife, and even so, my pack was as big as me by the time we'd finished. I asked Luke to hoist it onto a shelf in my closet, but Dad told me to keep it low, where I could fetch it quick, so I slept with it in my bed. I practiced slipping the bag onto my back and running with it. I didn't want to be left behind. I imagined our escape, a midnight flight to the safety of the princess. The mountain, I understood, was our ally. To those who knew her, she could be kind, but to intruders, she was pure treachery, and this would give us an advantage. Then again, if we were going to take cover on the mountain when the feds came, I didn't understand why we were canning all these peaches. We couldn't haul 1,000 heavy mason jars up the peak. Or did we need the peaches so we could bunker down in the house, like the weavers, and fight it out? Fighting it out seemed likely, especially a few days later when Dad came home with more than a dozen military surplus rifles, mostly SKSs, their thin silver bayonets folded neatly under their barrels. The guns arrived in narrow tin boxes and were packed in cosmoline, a brownish substance the consistency of lard that had to be stripped away. After they'd been cleaned, my brother Tyler chose one and set it on a sheet of black plastic, which he folded over the rifle, sealing it with yards of silvery duct tape. Hoisting the bundle onto his shoulder, he carried it down the hill and dropped it next to the red railroad car. Then he began to dig. When the hole was wide and deep, he dropped the rifle into it, and I watched him cover it with dirt, his muscles swelling from the exertion, his jaw clenched. Soon after, Dad bought a machine to manufacture bullets from spent cartridges. Now we could last longer in a standoff, he said. I thought of my head for the hills bag waiting in my bed and of the rifle hidden near the rail car and began to worry about the bullet-making machine. It was bulky and bolted to an iron workstation in the basement. If we were taken by surprise, I figured we wouldn't have time to fetch it. I wondered if we should bury it too, with the rifle. We kept on bottling peaches. I don't remember how many days passed or how many jars we'd added to our stores before Dad told us more of the story. "Randy Weaver's been shot," Dad said, his voice thin and erratic. "He left the cabin to fetch his son's body, and the feds shot him." I'd never seen my father cry, but now tears were dripping in a steady stream from his nose. He didn't wipe them, just let them spill onto his shirt. "His wife heard the shot and ran to the window, holding their baby. Then came the second shot." Mother was sitting with her arms folded, one hand across her chest, the other clamped over her mouth. I stared at our speckled linoleum while Dad told us how the baby had been lifted from its mother's arms, its face smeared with her blood. Until that moment, some part of me had wanted the feds to come, had craved the adventure. Now I felt real fear. I pictured my brothers crouching in the dark, their sweaty hands slipping down their rifles. I pictured Mother, tired and parched, drawing back away from the window. I pictured myself lying flat on the floor, still and silent, listening to the sharp chirp of crickets in the field. Then I saw Mother stand and reach for the kitchen tap. A white flash, the roar of gunfire, and she fell. I leapt to catch the baby. Dad never told us the end of the story. We didn't have a TV or radio, so perhaps he never learned how it ended himself. The last thing I remember him saying about it was, "Next time, it could be us." Those words would stay with me. I would hear their echo in the chirp of crickets, in the squish of peaches dropping into a glass jar, in the metallic chink of an SKS being cleaned. I would hear them every morning when I passed the railroad car and paused over the chickweed and bull thistle growing where Tyler had buried the rifle. Long after Dad had forgotten about the revelation in Isaiah, and Mother was again hefting plastic jugs of Western Family 2% into the fridge, I would remember the Weavers. It was almost 5 a.m. I returned to my room, my head full of crickets and gunfire. In the lower bunk, Audrey was snoring, a low, contented hum that invited me to do the same. Instead, I climbed up to my bed, crossed my legs, and looked out the window. 5 passed, then 6. At 7, Grandma appeared, and I watched her pace up and down her patio, turning every few moments to gaze up the hill at our house. Then, she and Grandpa stepped into their car and pulled onto the highway. When the car was gone, I got out of bed and ate a bowl of bran with water. Outside, I was greeted by Luke's goat, Kamikaze, who nibbled my shirt as I walked to the barn. I passed the go-kart Richard was building from an old lawnmower. I slopped the pigs, filled the trough, and moved Grandpa's horses to a new pasture. After I'd finished, I climbed the railway car and looked out over the valley. It was easy to pretend the car was moving, speeding away, that any moment the valley might disappear behind me. I'd spent hours playing that fantasy through in my head, but today, the real wouldn't take. I turned west, away from the fields, and faced the peak. The Princess was always brightest in spring, just after the conifers emerged from the snow, their deep green needles seeming almost black against the tawny browns of soil and bark. It was autumn now. I could still see her, but she was fading. The reds and yellows of a dying summer obscured her dark form. Soon it would snow. In the valley, that first snow would melt, but on the mountain it would linger, burying the Princess until spring, when she would reappear, watchful. Chapter 2. The Midwife. "Do you have calendula?" the midwife said. "I also need lobelia and witch hazel." She was sitting at the kitchen counter, watching Mother rummage through our birchwood cabinets. An electric scale sat on the counter between them, and occasionally Mother would use it to weigh dried leaves. It was spring. There was a morning chill, despite the bright sunlight. "I made a fresh batch of calendula last week," Mother said. "Tara, run and fetch it." I retrieved the tincture, and my mother packed it in a plastic grocery bag with the dried herbs. "Anything else?" Mother laughed. The pitch was high, nervous. The midwife intimidated her, and when intimidated, my mother took on a weightless quality, whisking about every time the midwife made one of her slow, solid movements. The midwife surveyed her list. "That will do." She was a short, plump woman in her late 40s, with 11 children and a russet-colored wart on her chin. She had the longest hair I'd ever seen, a cascade the color of field mice that fell to her knees when she took it out of its tight bun. Her features were heavy, her voice thick with authority. She had no license, no certificates. She was a midwife entirely by the power of her own say-so, which was more than enough. My mother was to be her assistant. I remember watching them that first day, comparing them. Mother with her rose petal skin and her hair curled into soft waves that bounced about her shoulders. Her eyelids shimmered. Mother did her makeup every morning, but if she didn't have time, she'd apologize all day, as if by not doing it, she had inconvenienced everyone. The midwife looked as though she hadn't given a thought to her appearance in a decade, and the way she carried herself made you feel foolish for having noticed. The midwife nodded goodbye, her arms full of mother's herbs. The next time the midwife came, she brought her daughter, Maria, who stood next to her mother, imitating her movements, with a baby wedged against her wiry, 9-year-old frame. I stared hopefully at her. I edged closer, trying to draw her attention, but she was wholly absorbed in listening to her mother, who was explaining how cramp bark and motherwort should be administered to treat post-birth contractions. Maria's head bobbed in agreement. Her eyes never left her mother's face. I trudged down the hall to my room, alone, but when I turned to shut the door, she was standing in it, still toting the baby on her hip. He was a meaty box of flesh, and her torso bent sharply at the waist to offset his bulk.
"Are you going?" she said.
I didn't understand the question.
"I always go," she said. "Have you seen a baby get born?"
"No."
"I have, lots of times. Do you know what it means when a baby comes breech?"
"No."
I said it like an apology. The first time Mother assisted with a birth, she was gone for 2 days. Then she wafted through the back door, so pale she seemed translucent, and drifted to the couch, where she stayed, trembling.
"It was awful," she whispered. "Even Judy said she was scared."
Mother closed her eyes.
"She didn't look scared."
Mother rested for several minutes until she regained some color. Then she told the story. The labor had been long, grueling, and when the baby finally came, the mother had torn, and badly. There was blood everywhere. The hemorrhage wouldn't stop. That's when Mother realized the umbilical cord had wrapped around the baby's throat. He was purple, so still Mother thought he was dead. As Mother recounted these details, the blood drained from her face until she sat, pale as an egg, her arms wrapped around herself. Audrey made chamomile tea, and we put our mother to bed. When Dad came home that night, Mother told him the same story.
"I can't do it," she said. "Judy can, but I can't."
Dad put an arm on her shoulder.
"This is a calling from the Lord," he said. "And sometimes the Lord asks for hard things."
Mother didn't want to be a midwife. Midwifery had been Dad's idea, one of his schemes for self-reliance. There was nothing he hated more than our being dependent on the government. Dad said one day we would be completely off the grid. As soon as he could get the money together, he planned to build a pipeline to bring water down from the mountain, and after that, he'd install solar panels all over the farm. That way we'd have water and electricity in the end of days, when everyone else was drinking from puddles and living in darkness. Mother was an herbalist, so she could tend our health, and if she learned to midwife, she would be able to deliver the grandchildren when they came along. The midwife came to visit Mother a few days after the first birth. She brought Maria, who again followed me to my room.
It's too bad your mother got a bad one her first time, she said, smiling. The next one will be easier.
A few weeks later, this prediction was tested. It was midnight. Because we didn't have a phone, the midwife called Grandma down the hill, who walked up the hill, tired and ornery, and barked that it was time for Mother to go play doctor. She stayed only minutes, but woke the whole house.
Why you people can't just go to a hospital like everyone else is beyond me, she shouted, slamming the door on her way out.
Mother retrieved her overnight bag and the tackle box she'd filled with dark bottles of tincture. Then she walked slowly out the door. I was anxious and slept badly, but when Mother came home the next morning, hair deranged and dark circles under her eyes, her lips were parted in a wide smile.
It was a girl, she said.
Then she went to bed and slept all day. Months passed in this way, Mother leaving the house at all hours and coming home, trembling, relieved to her core that it was over. By the time the leaves started to fall, she'd helped with a dozen births. By the end of winter, several dozen. In the spring, she told my father she'd had enough, that she could deliver a baby if she had to, if it was the end of the world. Now she could stop. Dad's face sank when she said this. He reminded her that this was God's will, that it would bless our family.
You need to be a midwife, he said. You need to deliver a baby on your own.
Mother shook her head.
I can't, she said. Besides, who would hire me when they could hire Judy?
She'd jinxed herself, thrown her gauntlet before God. Soon after, Maria told me her father had a new job in Wyoming.
Mom says your mother should take over, Maria said.
A thrilling image took shape in my imagination, of me in Maria's role, the midwife's daughter, confident, knowledgeable. But when I turned to look at my mother standing next to me, the image turned to vapor. Midwifery was not illegal in the state of Idaho, but it had not yet been sanctioned. If a delivery went wrong, a midwife might face charges for practicing medicine without a license. If things went very wrong, she could face criminal charges for manslaughter, even prison time. Few women would take such a risk, so midwives were scarce. On the day Judy left for Wyoming, Mother became the only midwife for 100 miles. Women with swollen bellies began coming to the house and begging Mother to deliver their babies. Mother crumpled at the thought. One woman sat on the edge of our faded yellow sofa, her eyes cast downward as she explained that her husband was out of work and they didn't have money for a hospital. Mother sat quietly, eyes focused, lips tight, her whole expression momentarily solid. Then the expression dissolved and she said in her small voice,
I'm not a midwife, just an assistant.
The woman returned several times, perching on our sofa again and again, describing the uncomplicated births of her other children. Whenever Dad saw the woman's car from the junkyard, he'd often come into the house, quietly, through the back door, on the pretense of getting water. Then he'd stand in the kitchen, taking slow, silent sips, his ear bent toward the living room. Each time the woman left, Dad could hardly contain his excitement, so that finally, succumbing to either the woman's desperation or to Dad's elation, or to both, Mother gave way. The birth went smoothly. Then the woman had a friend who was also pregnant, and Mother delivered her baby as well. Then that woman had a friend. Mother took on an assistant. Before long, she was delivering so many babies that Audrey and I spent our days driving around the valley with her, watching her conduct prenatal exams and prescribe herbs. She became our teacher in a way that, because we rarely held school at home, she'd never been before. She explained every remedy and palliative. If so-and-so's blood pressure was high, she should be given hawthorn to stabilize the collagen and dilate the coronary blood vessels. If Mrs. Someone or Other was having premature contractions, she needed a bath in ginger to increase the supply of oxygen to the uterus. Midwifing changed my mother. She was a grown woman with 7 children, But this was the first time in her life that she was, without question or caveat, the one in charge. Sometimes, in the days after a birth, I detected an